Well, as we were seeing this morning in chapter 3 of Ecclesiastes, the preacher was telling us that there is a time for everything. And in particular, there is a time for judgment. He said in chapter 3, verse 17, "I said in my heart, God will judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time for every matter and for every work." And now in chapter 4, the preacher goes on to show us why this is such good news for God's people. I don't know if you've ever considered that God's judgment is good news for those in particular who have trusted in Christ alone for salvation. And to show us that it really is good news, he now returns to his examination of life under the sun. And he's going to consider the oppressions we face. And so as we look at this passage, let's see four areas where the preacher explores where he sees injustice occurring. Oppression and injustice. So four areas. Firstly, the preacher sees oppression in the courts, verses 1 to 3. Oppression in the courts. Now, the courts are the most logical place for the preacher to begin as he begins to look for justice in this world and as he's just been speaking about judgment that takes place. And in the Old Testament, justice was an important issue to the people. Well, certainly it was an important issue to God. In the law of God, in the Old Testament, God made it very clear that the courts and the judges who were appointed were to uphold certain standards. In particular, they were to ensure the safety and the protection and the provision of the weakest of society, to keep them from being exploited by those more powerful than them, and who might have evil intent. So this included the temporary resident, the person who has come within your gates. You will often find as a phrase in the Old Testament. Also the fatherless child and the widowed woman. And of course, the New Testament continues that same ethical tradition, where in the letter of James, we see that true religion is to care for the widowed and the orphaned. Now, this meant that the judges were to look at cases both honestly and fairly. Deuteronomy chapter 1, verses 16 to 17 says, God is speaking, "I charged your judges at that time, hear the cases between your brothers and judge righteously between a man and his brother or the alien who is with him. You shall not be partial in judgment. You shall hear the small and great alike. You shall not be intimidated by anyone, for the judgment is God's. And the case that is too hard for you, you shall bring to me, and I will hear it." And so throughout the Old Testament, God again and again, through the prophets, speaks to the people of Israel, particularly those in positions of prominent power, to be fair, to act righteously, to defend the rights that the law gave to those who were particularly weak and vulnerable. But as the preacher enters the courts in Israel, as he's writing, what does he find in Ecclesiastes 4? Well, he finds corrupt officials. "Again, I saw all the oppressions that are done under the sun," he says in verse 1. "And behold, the tears of the oppressed, and they had no one to comfort them. On the side of their oppressors, there was power, and there was no one to comfort them." The people, the preacher sees a people who are distressed by the way they are being oppressed. But instead of helping the innocent, those who held power, those whose power was on their side, those who had the power to judge their cases, to vindicate them, to deliver them from such harshness and unfairness, they weren't doing anything to bring them comfort. Instead, they were standing back at a distance saying, "Not my problem." And by by not dealing with the issues, the evil things that were going on in Israel, which the preacher alludes to in verse 3, and we're not told explicitly what those evil deeds were, but certainly the preacher sees what that there is real corruption going on in the society at that time. And certainly the prophets would collaborate with the preacher as they would come again and again to the people of Israel, condemning the unrighteous judges of Israel who were not going on the side of the vulnerable, but going on the side of the powerful. And by not actually taking any care for these people, they have become complicit in the evil actions of those who are oppressing God's nation. Why are they doing nothing? Well, we know the old story. Perhaps some have taken bribes from the wealthy, or maybe they've been placed under political pressure. That perhaps it was in their political interest to they promised prominent places to sit. Perhaps they were promised that they would have a job for a lifetime, as long as they towed the party line. But either way, they had the ability to stop the evil being done, but they did nothing. Power was on their side and not on the people's. And instead of using their power for good and godly means, they used it for bad. Now, let's be clear. God hates injustice. God hates injustice. He found corrupt officials. But secondly, the preacher found comfortless people. Look at verses 2 to 3. I thought the dead who are already dead more fortunate than the living who are still alive. But better than both is he who has not yet been born and has not seen the evil deeds that are done under the sun. Do you see the cynical outlook of the preacher as he looks at the oppression of the people? As he sees how distressed and how discomforted they are, the startling conclusion that the preacher makes is this: I'm envious of the dead. Because the dead are in a better condition than those who are experiencing this kind of oppression. And the only thing more preferable than death, the only people in a better position than those who have already died, are who? Those who just haven't been born. And why is that? Well, because while the dead have escaped their oppression, the unborn will never live to experience it. They'll never live to see it. You see, we mustn't think that the Bible is ignorant of all the evils that happens in the world. And neither must we be. Do we ever take a time, like the preacher here, this godly man in Ecclesiastes, to actually look at what's going on in our world? To actually take notice of the injustice that takes place? And what's our response to it? Has it become a habit to watch the news and just switch it off and go to bed? Unmoved, unfeeling? Happy it's not you? No, like the preacher, we shouldn't be unmoved, particularly when we see the powerful oppressing the innocent. What should we do? Well, it seems today that there's no end of protest. I think there's more news about, I don't know if it's just there's more protest or the media are more interested in it, but certainly it seems that there's no end of protest about this issue and that issue and the other issue. But what do we do as believers? Well, I think we have something better than stand outside Westminster. You see, the Bible tells us that we should be those who pray. Pray for those who are in places of power and influence. Listen to what Paul says in 1 Timothy 2. And he's speaking to Timothy, a young man who is temporarily pastoring a church. And he says this, giving him instructions of how he should pastor. I urge that supplications, prayers, intercessions, and thanksgivings be made for all people, for kings and all who are in high positions. And remember, they didn't live in a democracy. And so if you had a leader who you didn't like, there was no ballot box. There was no 5 years' time. There was no call for a different government. When you had a government you didn't like, you were stuck with that government, that king, that emperor, until they were either replaced or died. Paul says, how are you to respond to them, even the ones you don't like? And typically, let's be honest, the Roman emperors didn't clothe themselves in much dignity. He says, you should pray for kings and all who are in high positions. And why should we do that, Paul? That we as believers may lead a peaceful and quiet life, godly and dignified in every way. It's interesting to me, I think, that the older I'm getting, the more convinced I am that noisy Christianity, by which I mean sort of, you know, the real, I've got to try and put this into words, it's not in my notes, that's why I usually have notes, the sort of noisy, make a stand, radical Christianity that seems to attract the young so quickly is not the sort of lives God calls us to. Now, God does call us to a radical life, by the way. Jesus says, if you don't take up your cross and follow me, which means if you're not prepared to die for me and because of me, then you're not worthy of me. Okay, so I'm not saying that we shouldn't live Christ-inspired, radical Christian lives. But what I am saying is this, that living the normal, ordinary Christian life is radical in and of itself because it is so countercultural. And so let's not try and put additional things in our lives that cause us to seem even stranger than we already are. Just admit it, we're strange. And to cause us not to be to be loud and almost obnoxious. That's the way of the world. How does the way of the world get their point across? By shouting loudly, stamping their feet and sounding arrogant. The Christian isn't to do that. The Christian isn't to do that. Paul says, pray for those who are in power, that not that you may overthrow them, but that you may lead a peaceful and a quiet life, godly and dignified in every way. Now look, there are times, don't get me wrong, there are times when it's appropriate to protest. I haven't seen many protests on the telly recently that I'd like to join. There may be times when it is appropriate to protest, when it is appropriate to petition government. But may it never, ever take the place of prayer in our lives. May it never be that we would protest before we pray. May it never be that we complain and petition a government without praying first. There is oppression in the courts. Secondly, the preacher sees oppression in the markets, verses 4 to 6. Oppression in the markets. And so the preacher, who is Solomon, he's previously reminded us that work is a gift from God. Remember that on Monday morning. Work is a gift from God that has been given to us to strengthen and help and reassure our well-being and bring us even pleasure. And so as he goes out to the market, he sees three different types of laborers who sadly reveal even more oppressions. Firstly, he sees the industrious, verse 4. Then I saw that all toil and all skill in work come from a man's envy of his neighbor. This also is vanity. That word vanity, it means it's futile, it's fleeting, and a striving after the wind. So here's a man, imagine this. Here's a man who's been gifted with great skill and ability that he's been able to use to build up his business year after year. He's successful. But as a preacher looks at him, the preacher sees beyond his success and sees the oppression that his work has become to him. And why is his work an oppression? Well, because he's not working as to the Lord. He's not working because he sees that that's a gift from God, that he's been able to do that, that God has given him the strength to do it and the ability to do it. And so he's using it to glorify God. This man's work oppresses him because he is working in order to gain what his neighbor has and he doesn't. So he's looking at the car his neighbor drives and he's saying, I want that. I want that car, not the shoddy Corsa I've got on my driveway. I'm using that because I think I've got a Corsa. I can't quite remember what I've got. I have been known to say I've got a Fiat when actually I gave the garage a Vauxhall. But he's saying, I want that. I don't have that and I need that. And so I'm going to work with all my energy to get that. And the problem is that he's never satisfied with what he has. And once he even gets that, there's something else that he doesn't have that he wants that he has to work for. And so with a heart full of envy, he's never happy with his labor. He's never happy with the results it brings. He's industrious, but he's full of envy and his work is an oppression to him. Are you oppressed by work in that way? Envious of what others have that you don't have? And so work is simply a means of getting that, but it's an unending cycle. That's an oppression. And then on the opposite extreme, the preacher sees the idol. Here is a person who isn't working hard. What's he doing? Verse 5, the fool folds his hands and eats his own flesh. The folding of the hands, it's that's just sort of, you know, just keeping them there is like this and not doing anything with them. It's a typical Old Testament phrase for laziness. The folding of the hands. He doesn't see the point in going out to work. He doesn't see the point in being as industrious as that man he sees in the marketplace. He's happy to sit down. He's happy to have a late morning. He's happy to do nothing. What's his oppression? It doesn't sound like he could surely be oppressed. After all, who doesn't like a late morning? I've just had 2 weeks' worth of holiday. I've thoroughly enjoyed my late mornings and my doing nothing. I sat down for 2 weeks. It was wonderful. What's the problem with that? Well, God's made us to work. And he's built us to do that. And this man, by his idleness, is committing an act of self-harm as he refuses to work. Look how the preacher describes it. It's like he's eating his own flesh. It's sort of that self-cannibalism. He's consuming himself. He's not doing anything good for himself. He's not living the way God had intended him to live. And this too is an oppression. And surely there's a middle ground. Well, there is, verse 6. Better is a handful of quietness than two hands full of toil and a striving after wind. The preacher saying here, isn't it better to have one hand with the results of your labor and another hand of quietness? Isn't it better to have one hand that works hard, one hand that rests? He's essentially saying a balanced life. A balanced life is better. Both of these two are living on the extreme end. Both of these two are oppressed. But then thirdly, he sees the independent. Verse 7 to 8. Again, I saw vanity under the sun. One person who has no other, either son or brother, yet there is no end to all his toil, and his eyes are never satisfied with riches, so that he never asks, for whom am I toiling and depriving myself of pleasure? This also is vanity and an unhappy business. So here again, we're introduced to another person who's working very hard. You can't fault him that. And he's working so hard that he never stops to enjoy it. He never stops to rest. This is someone who has sacrificed family and friends and relationships for the sake of becoming a success. That's been his whole goal. But while this has seemed so good for a time, in the end, he faces the oppression of isolation. How sad it is when someone has lived in that way. They've not invested in their relationships. They've not invested in people, and they get to the end of their life. Their work is done, and they have no one. They look around and there's no one in their life. What was it all for? How do we avoid the same oppressions that these three men endured? Well, the preacher's already told us. He's told us we can avoid it by being content with what God has already given us. Live a life of contentedness. Be thankful for what God has given you. Because everything you have is a gift from God. But the New Testament would also add that we shouldn't work simply to be applauded by men, but we should work as to the Lord for his glory. And only then will our work be something that brings the fulfillment that God desires for us to know. Well, thirdly, the preacher sees oppression in the streets. He's seen oppression in the courts, oppression in the markets. Now he finds oppression in the streets in verses 9 to 12. So he's already seen that there's no one who can offer comfort to the innocent who are oppressed in court. And he's now seen a man who has sacrificed family and friends on the altar of his own career. So now he begins to consider the importance of companionship. And he begins to think of companionship and the benefits companionship brings. And what benefits does he note? Well, he observes that companionship provides help. Two, verse 9, two are better than one because they have a good reward for their toil. For if they fall, one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him who is alone when he falls and has not another to lift him up. He observes companionship provides help. Why are two better than one? Two are better than one because with two, you can double the work and you can double the reward. You have someone to share with, even if you don't double the reward. You have someone who you can enjoy it with. That's far better than having a stack of wealth and looking around and going, well, who's this for? I don't need anything. I don't have anyone to share it with or to be generous towards. What a miserable condition that is to be in. But not only this in our successes, but also in our failures. Where there is one person, there's greater risk. Where there's one person, there's greater damage. But when there are two people, if one falls down, and whether that's physical or emotional or spiritual, there's another one there who's able to pick them up, who's able to help them, who's able to strengthen them. This should remind us of how God said in the beginning when he made the first man that there was one thing in all of creation that wasn't good. Each day ended, it was good, it was good, it was good, it was good. The one thing that wasn't good in creation was that the man was alone. That the man was on his own. And so God created a woman to be with him and from them to create a whole society. God has made us as social creatures. And so companionship is a good thing. And he observes that companionship provides comfort, secondly. It provides comfort, verse 11. Again, if two lie together, they keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? Now, some people may have suggested that this might be talking about marriage, how a married couple will share the same bed and they're able to keep each other warm, and that's lovely, but actually I don't think that fits the context and is also reading our culture into the Bible. Because though it might be uncommon for us to do this, it was common back then when you went on a journey and you would, as friends, it would be common to lie next to each other at night in order to keep each other warm. There's no sexual connotation here. It was just a practical arrangement. It was just a practical way of, you know, like penguins huddling up, they keep each other warm. And so the Lone Ranger, who's going on a journey on his own, has no one to go with him, he's more likely to be cold when the sun goes down. And so what does he have to do? Well, he has to pack extra things. He has to carry additional items, making his journey more difficult. And so companionship provides help and companionship provides comfort. But thirdly, the preacher observes that companionship provides protection. Verse 12, and though a man might prevail against one who is alone, two will withstand him. A threefold cord is not quickly broken. Remember the story of the Good Samaritan. The story of the Good Samaritan reminds us or shows us that it was a pretty dangerous thing for someone to walk and travel alone in Israel in that time and culture in the ancient world. Because along the road you would be vulnerable to being robbed, to being beaten up, to being left at the side of the road half dead, as the man in the Good Samaritan parable was. And so it was not typical for people to walk or travel alone. It was dangerous. And so having someone with you on your journey would help limit the risk of attack. But notice the way the preacher heaps up the numbers. Though a man might prevail against one who is alone, two will withstand him, a threefold cord is not quickly broken. And so he's not saying here that, you know, if you go out walking, you better have someone with you. It's simply talking about the beauty of community. It doesn't matter if it's two, three, or even more. It provides that protection. It provides help and comfort and protection. It's a good thing to have friends and family with you in along life's journey. But understand, the preacher isn't unaware that relationships in this life are not perfect. He's not unaware that relationships in this life are not perfect. That relationships in this life will bring their own problems. After all, I'll often joke with people, tongue in cheek. It's kind of got a truth in there. In a marriage, don't expect that everything will become simple because it's two sinners committing to one another to live together. Kind of, there's one sinner in my house, and that's bad enough. In this life, in this world, relationships can be difficult, and the preacher isn't unaware of that. But he does see that through companionship, the normal oppressions of life that we all experience in one way or another are limited and easier to bear because we can carry them together. And you don't have to be married, by the way, to have companionship with and someone to carry burdens with. Can't we be thankful that we should that as Christians we not only have one another, having been placed in a community? That's why it's so important to invest in fellowship. That's why it's so important to not only see each other as faces on a Sunday or a Tuesday, but actually to get to know each other and to know each other more and more. You won't know everyone as well as like deeply, but it's important as a church to get to know each other, to build those relationships together. We should be thankful that God has put us in a community so we can help each other along in the Christian life. The Christian life, from what I've observed, is very, very difficult, near impossible to live outside of a church community. But more than that, particularly those of you who live alone, I hope you realize that that you can be thankful because you're not alone, ever. Because you have a friend in Jesus. And Jesus sticks closer than any brother and is more faithful than any partner. The oppression in the streets, but finally, the preacher sees oppression in the palaces, verses 13 to 16, oppression in the palaces. And there's two people here he takes time to watch. There's an older king and a younger king. And this is a riches to rags story told in just a few verses. Now, various people have wondered whether these are real people who the preacher's talking about. So some suggestions have been Joseph and Pharaoh. Others have suggested David and Saul. And you may even put in the suggestion of Abimelech and David. It seems this older king, younger man, coming up, rising, taking his place. It seems that people are eager to kind of match it to some historical figure in the Old Testament. I don't think it's very likely that the preacher is drawing on anyone in particular, but it seems more likely that he's using a picture that is a general picture. It's a scenario that has happened again and again in various places throughout human history. The young grow up and sort of take the place of the old, and then the cycle repeats. But look what happens to these two men. Firstly, let's think about the older man in verse 13. It says, "Better was a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who no longer knew how to take advice." It's quite a striking verse, isn't it? Better was a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who no longer knew how to take advice. Here's a king who's been reigning over his kingdom for many, many years. And the problem is we can be so experienced in life that we think that's wisdom. Wisdom is an experience. Experience doesn't always lead to wisdom. Here is a king, and he's described as a fool. And yet he's reigned over his kingdom for many, many, many years. And why is he a fool? Because the more experience he's had, the more confident in himself he is. So that he no longer listens to his top and closest advisors, thinking they cannot teach him anything and he knows everything. That's sometimes the problem with experience, isn't it? But sometimes, just because we've experienced something doesn't mean we've learnt from something and doesn't mean we know best. Because the result is that the people who brought this king to power no longer want him there anymore. And so we come to the younger man, verse 14, 16. For he went from, so better was a poor and wise youth, for he went from prison to the throne. Though in his own kingdom he had been poor. I saw all the living who move about under the sun, along with that youth who was to stand in the king's place. There was no end of all the people, all of whom he led. Yet those who come later will not rejoice in him. Surely this also is vanity and a striving after wind. So unbeknownst to the older king, his advisors have now taken notice of a new prospect. A young, wise man. A man who has less experience but more wisdom. And when we consider that wisdom is a gift from God, there are people who can be wiser beyond their years, who are able to speak more better than those who should know better. And they've taken a liking to him. And so they bring him into their kingdom. They clothe him in riches and they sit him on the throne. And it goes well for a while. This young man is gaining popularity with the people in the kingdom. But then something happens to the young man. What is it that happens to the young man? He stops being young. And there are people who come up who didn't know the old king and who don't remember this young man in his youth. And they're not as impressed in him and his abilities as the ones who went before them. Do you know Oliver Cromwell? Not personally, just do you know about Oliver Cromwell? Oliver Cromwell led the English Civil War and successfully dethroned Charles I. And following his victory, he said to a friend, "Do not trust to the cheering, for these persons would shout as much if you and I were going to be hanged." People are fickle. Popularity is fleeting. You don't need to be a king to be a person who lives for the praise and the applause of men. The cheers of a crowd, well, let's be honest, the cheers of just one person can be intoxicating. But ultimately, even this can be another form of oppression. Because as quickly as they put you on a pedestal, they will just as quickly drop you from it. Instead, we ought to live for an audience of one by seeking to please God in everything we do as we obey his word, to please him even when it doesn't please others. The preacher's proven there is injustice and oppression in every area of life under the sun. So don't be surprised when you see corruption, even in places that have been institutionally set up to prevent it. Because that's the nature of human beings. We're sinful to the core. So where can we find true justice? Well, we don't look to man, but we look to the one who judges the world perfectly. Remember I said, the truth of that God is going to judge the world one day is good news. And it's good news because of the oppression we see in society. It's good news because we see everywhere, from the palace to the streets, there is corruption in every corner. And it has always been that way. And it always will be that way until the Lord Jesus Christ returns. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't seek to make things better. Jesus told us to be salt and light. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't do everything we can to help those who are being oppressed. But it does mean that we shouldn't put all of our trust and all of our hopes in a political party or in a charitable organization, however flash and good that charity is, we shouldn't even put our trust in ourselves. We trust the one who judges the world perfectly, the one who will bring an end to all injustice, the one who will come to make everything as it should be, to bring what we all long for, to make this world as it ought to be, free from sin, free from injustice, free from oppression. And only Jesus Christ can do that. Because Jesus Christ came the first time to pay the penalty for our sins on the cross, as he died in our place, so that we might be forgiven for all the wrong, all the corruption, all the injustice, all the oppression that we have done as sinners. But he's coming again. And the second time he comes, he will make everything that is not right to be right. Do you long for that day? Listen to how the Apostle John envisioned that day in his Revelation, in the final book of the Bible, Revelation 21. Then I saw, so the preacher's been telling us what he saw, but listen to John. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them as their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain any more, for the former things have passed away. And all God's people said, Amen.